Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Rebecca Hersher. As a correspondent on NPR's Climate Desk, you may have heard my voice reporting on the UN Climate Conference last fall or covering massive ice storms that battered states from New Mexico to New York just a few weeks ago. But as today's host on Midday, I'm excited to talk about environmental news a little closer to home and dig into some climate stories happening right here in Maryland. Later in the program, we'll check in on offshore wind farms planned for the Eastern Shore and hear how Baltimore is working to be more resilient in the face of increasingly intense flooding. But first, Maryland's ambitious goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Those goals were passed by state lawmakers in 2022. Now, that was a time when the federal government was led by an administration that was generally supporting clean energy, and it was prioritizing tackling climate change. Now, not so much. To tell us where we stand, my first guest is Adam Willis, climate and environment reporter at the Baltimore Banner. He joins me in Studio A. Welcome back to Midday, Adam.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. And you can join us too. How are you feeling about climate change these days? How does it rank among all of your day-to-day concerns? And I know a lot of us have a lot of them. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780, or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. And Adam, let's start with carbon emissions. So we're talking here about carbon dioxide, methane, other planet warming pollution that actually causes climate change. By law, Maryland has committed to cut those pollutants by 60% by the year 2031. And how are we doing on that goal?
Not great. So I wrote a story recently about a report that came out from some University of Maryland researchers. It's a bit basically modeling that projects where we can expect to be in 2031, and I think out to 2035. The short answer is that we are further behind from where this same group of researchers had projected we would be just a couple of years ago when they did a similar report. We're on track, I think, to be about a 42% reduction by 2031.
So much less than 60.
Well behind. And even in their initial analysis from a couple of years ago, they'd said greenhouse gas emissions would have gone down by half. So still behind at that point, but we're even further behind now.
Got it. So we're actually falling behind the behindness that we were just a few years ago. And why is that? You know, there's been a lot of talk recently about electric vehicles. There's been a huge uptick in electric vehicles. And then there's also been a, you know, pulling back from federal policies that support electric vehicles. Is that related at all to Maryland's goals?
It's absolutely related. So these researchers looked at a couple of different factors, and the transportation sector is a big piece of this. So transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions in Maryland.
Mm-hmm. And in the U.S. more broadly, I think.
Right. The researchers, when they previously did this report, had expected the greenhouse gas emissions from that sector to go down something like 38%. Mm. We're now looking at a 23% reduction, I think, so we're slipping behind there. And a lot of that does have to do with policies that the Trump administration has put into place, trying to roll back regulations that states like California and Maryland have put in place to control emissions from cars and get people to adopt electric vehicles.
Right. And just recently, the Trump administration made changes that really makes it easier for automakers to make gas-guzzling vehicles for more years before they transition to electric vehicles. So you could see how that would sort of impact the timing of when emissions go down here in Maryland. Are there other ways that the Trump administration's policies are making it harder for Maryland to reach its goals? You know, for example, later in the hour, we're going to talk about offshore wind energy and how the federal government is attacking that industry. Does that factor into these estimates at all?
Yeah, I was interested in this piece. Offshore wind was not explicitly, or I should say that Trump's policies on offshore wind were not explicitly factored in here because in some ways it's more of a rhetorical assault that he's been waging here and pulling back permits. But the only project that's permitted in Maryland still retains its permit, though it's being litigated in court right now. So offshore wind doesn't play a huge factor in the numbers that we're looking at here. But that said, it is a big factor when we're having this broader conversation about Maryland's efforts to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. The Trump administration's attacks on the offshore wind industry have made for a pretty grim outlook for this industry off the coast of Maryland. And the truth is that that is going to need to be a big part of the state's electricity generation portfolio if the state's going to really roll back its reliance on fossil fuels and specifically natural gas.
Right, because natural gas, although it is a cleaner fossil fuel, quote unquote cleaner, than something like coal, it does still produce a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. So just to step back for a moment, you know, if we're thinking about the causes of Maryland not meeting its goals here, because there is so much focus on federal action, I just want to put a fine point on it. You know, without the Trump administration's policy changes here, would Maryland be on track to meet its goals?
The short answer is no. So like I said, when these same researchers did this study a couple of years ago before the Trump administration, we were still looking at a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2031, which is below, well below still the goal of 60% by that date. Interestingly, when these researchers modeled out this these reductions on the longer term out to say 2045, the net loss or the lost ground isn't that significant. We kind of come out to about the same place and make up for some of the losses that we expect to have under Trump administration policies. But even then, I think they're looking at something like 60-something, 65% reduction in greenhouse gases by that 2045 date, which coincidentally is the date when the state says it should be net zero. There should be on net no greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah. I think one thing that's really interesting about, you know, it's a lot of numbers, but they have real meaning because the faster we reduce emissions, the fewer lives are lost, the less economic impact from climate change. It's not really one of these things where as long as you reduce emissions to zero, eventually everything will be fine. It really is a the faster the better game. And so when we talk about losing ground, that, you know, that seems really meaningful.
It's absolutely significant. And I guess the one other piece I'd want to add here is that I don't think that this comes as a surprise to Maryland elected leaders. You know, when they passed that Climate Solutions Now Act back in 2022, which is what set these really ambitious goals, they knew they were ambitious. No one at the time thought that they were setting goals that were going to be easily achieved, but they did put these goals into statute. Secretary McElwain, the Secretary of Environment for the state, said when these modeled numbers were presented earlier this month that we shouldn't be surprised by them. We knew that these goals were ambitious, and we also she really focused on some of the impacts that we're seeing from the Trump administration and said, you know, we knew that this administration was going to set us back. Mm. So I don't think anyone in the top of Maryland government is surprised by the challenges we're facing here.
Mm. Yeah, but the average person might be.
Sure.
Yeah, important to keep an eye on it. I'm Rebecca Hersher, and this is Midday. I'm speaking with Adam Willis, climate reporter at the Baltimore Banner. We're talking about Maryland's emission reductions goals. If you'd like to join that conversation, give us a call, 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. Now, Adam, one of the things that I found really interesting about your reporting on this is the connection to AI. So AI requires these gigantic data centers full of servers. They use a lot of electricity. And can you talk about how those data centers are driving up greenhouse gas emissions here in Maryland?
Data centers are going to be a huge part of this conversation. They already are a dominant part of our conversations about how we're going to tackle these goals and tackle climate change going forward. Data centers are an enormous suck on power. And because of this AI race that we're finding ourselves in now, we are seeing some pretty staggering projections for new demand on the power grid from data centers. I was talking to David Lapp, with the Office of the People's Council recently, and he's a ratepayer advocate, and he was basically pointing to, I think it was demands on the order of the entire state of Maryland that are projected out of Northern Virginia over the next decade or so. Yeah. The numbers are just kind of mind-blowing. Whether all of that is real or just speculative is kind of a million-dollar question right now, but regardless, there's expected to be big new demands put on the grid. And things like solar and wind, renewable energy sources that don't emit, aren't always capable of meeting the demand from these kinds of data centers because of sort of the around-the-clock needs that they have. You start to see a lot of companies turning to, and utilities turning to natural gas, and turning to, in some cases, nuclear, which doesn't emit greenhouse gas emissions, but in the case of natural gas, which is seeing a lot more usage these days, we're absolutely driving up emissions by turning our reliance to natural gas.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge thing unfolding, not just here in Maryland, but all over the country. This tension, I think, between wanting to reduce emissions and move toward more sustainable electricity and this enormous pressure on electricity generation to try to, in some cases, as you said, like double it in a region very quickly. There is a big fight unfolding here in our state, in Annapolis, over electricity, partly for data centers, and specifically about who gets to build new power plants in Maryland, because there is so much electricity demand. First, can you talk about how does it work right now? Who gets to build new power plants in Maryland?
Sure. So it's worth maybe understanding a little bit of the history here. Today, power plants are built and owned by what are called merchant generators. These are companies that operate on private markets. They compete with other companies to earn a profit from developing and operating power plants. Mm. Utilities, which you know people will be familiar with, BGE and Pepco, the people they pay their bills to, do not own or operate these power plants. They operate the power delivery systems, the power lines, and things like that. And that's because of a sort of deregulatory wave that we saw in Maryland and in a lot of other states dating back to the 1990s that basically prevented these utilities from owning both the sources of generation and the power lines that get the power to your house.
Got it. And there is a bill introduced in the Maryland State House last week that could change that, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
It would be really consequential should it pass. So Exelon, which is the company that owns Pepco, BGE, and Delmarva Power in Maryland, is pushing a bill that would roll back that decades-old policy in Maryland to allow utilities to get into the generation game. The reason has a lot to do with what we were just talking about. They're arguing that we have all of these new demands from data centers and other sources coming onto the power grid, and the state and the region need every tool that they can get, basically, to supply more power to the grid. But if this were to pass in the legislature, it would be a significant rollback on basically decades of utility policy, and could also have pretty substantial impacts for Maryland customers and ratepayers, because what BGE is essentially looking for here, and Exelon is looking for, is the ability to build power plants and then to pass off the costs of that development to their ratepayers. So, in other words, paying for it on your monthly bill.
Got it. Going back to some of that history there, what was the logic behind making sure that companies couldn't do this in the first place?
Yeah. To my understanding, it had a lot to do with sort of preventing vertical integration, that you didn't want to have a company having sort of control of the entire energy supply line there from the point of generation to the point of delivery to your home, because it would be anti-competitive and would hurt customers at their wallets.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the possibility that this could drive up costs. I, for one, do not need higher costs on my BG&E bill. They're plenty high. What is the sort of counterargument to this bill that you're hearing from ratepayer advocates and other people who sort of watch out for the little guys?
It's mainly that cost argument. I mean, there's this bill has been a source of a lot of consternation and argument in Annapolis in the last couple of weeks. Which is also interesting and telling, because so far it doesn't seem to have broad support. So it has, last I checked, a sponsor on the Senate side, and it was recently introduced on the House side as well. But you sort of have these lone wolf lawmakers who are carrying it. No one else is really attaching their name to the idea right now. Even so, it's created quite a furor from different sectors, particularly from ratepayer advocates and climate advocates who are making that point and that argument that if Exelon is allowed to do this, they can pass off the costs of, say, building a natural gas plant or solar farms to their customers. BG says they don't want to build natural gas, that they're just looking to build renewables and batteries through this. But Currently, the bill would allow them to build gas as written right now. It would allow them to build gas. So there would be big cost implications. The one other thing I'd add is that because they are a monopoly utility regulated by the Maryland Public Service Commission, they're able to recover costs, they're able to earn a rate of return on the costs of these developments as well. So they basically have like a guarantee and return margin that it makes it easier for them to earn a profit off of it. So there's a financial incentive that you can see for utilities to pursue these kinds of policies.
Got it. And just to sort of connect the two pieces of our conversation here, you mentioned that this bill, as currently written, would allow for natural gas development in Maryland. Obviously, natural gas is a fossil fuel. It emits greenhouse gases that warm the planet. It contributes to the greenhouse gases that are setting Maryland back from its goals of reducing climate pollution. So how do you see these two things sort of playing with each other? This push to build more power plants, potentially ones that burn fossil fuels, and this push to also reduce greenhouse gas emissions as quickly as possible, you know, before some of these deadlines like 2031.
It's a huge tension. I mean, I should caveat that, like I said, BGE is saying that they only want to use this authority to build non-emitting battery storage and community solar. But some of the ratepayer advocates and climate advocates don't buy that argument. They see this as basically laying a pathway for future construction of fossil fuel plants and natural gas. And the reality is, with the demand that's coming onto the grid, there is going to be a growing appetite from utilities. And we've seen in Maryland from political leaders, from lawmakers, in developing more natural gas. So whether or not that, you know, is a result of this specific policy legislation or not, there's a whole lot more conversation right now about getting more natural gas on the grid to respond to what could be pretty enormous demand and in recent years, not precedented demand from data centers.
That's Adam Willis, climate and environment reporter at WYPR's news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we return, are Maryland's offshore wind farms dead in the water? Aman Uzzer has the latest. It's Midday. I'm host Rebecca Hersher. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm host Rebecca Hersher. Coming up on Monday, WYPR's Gabe Ortiz returns to the host chair. We'll hear the latest on redistricting from WYPR's Sarah Petrovich. Hear from journalists with the Baltimore Sun-Guild, who are unhappy with the paper's use of AI-generated articles. That's on Monday. Today, we're getting a roundup of climate-related stories across Maryland. Now we head to the Eastern Shore, where offshore wind turbines were a critical part of those clean energy goals we just heard about earlier in the show. My next guest is Aman Uzzer. He's a reporter with Inside Climate News covering the DMV, and he joins me on Zoom. Welcome back to the program, Aman.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Glad to be here.
And you can join us, too. How do you feel about Maryland's green energy goals? Give us a call at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. Or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Aman, we just heard from Adam Willis, who covers energy and the environment for the Baltimore Banner, about how Maryland is not on track to meet its climate goals. And at the same time, there's a push to build more power plants in the state. You've been reporting on changes to the state's pot of money for clean energy investment and plans to take money out of that fund. Tell us about that plan.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was a source of contention early on. In last year, this was a problem which advocates and environmentalists conveyed to the Moore administration that this fund, which is Strategic Investment, Clean Energy Investment Fund, that should not be, you know, used for any budget backfilling. And that apparently didn't happen because we see in the latest proposal, the 2027 budget proposal, that would leave just 82% of a drain on that fund, which is going from over 800 million down to just 164 million. So that's a problem. And that's also a political problem for advocates, how to get on, how to support that plan. So and this is an election year. So as I wrote in my last report, it's an awkward kind of political dance that the environmental groups and the Moore administration kind of have to do. And what I've done in my known in my reporting is that they have gotten on board the environmental groups to the key parts of this drawdown, particularly the ones which has increased the funding to 328 million. This is the estimate that advocates have shared with me, and that's quite a lot of increase, by the way, from 2024, which was estimated to be around 148 million. So while at the same time there's more money going towards clean energy and efficient energy portfolio in the state, so is the money going towards a general fund, and that is where the problem really comes around. Because if it's this drain is going to leave only under 200 million, then how are we going to think about the medium to long term investments into clean and efficient energy projects with the focus on equity? Because this fund, that's a core rationale for having this fund. So that's a delicate dance that's continuing. We still have to see that how the new proposal that the advocates are coming out with, that they need at least 365 million going forward year-on-year investment coming out of CEIF. That's at least what they're lobbying lawmakers to legislate. First, we have to see if how far this proposal will fly, and second, if it does, then how are they going to ensure that CEIF will have that sort of a money going forward? Because clearly this year it doesn't.
And you're talking a little bit about the uses for this very important fund and how crucial it is for upgrading Maryland's solar energy, wind energy, these clean energy sources. We have a caller in Frederick, Jamie from Frederick, who has a question about solar. Go ahead, Jamie.
Hey, folks. I'm curious if there's any initiatives in place to try and empower consumers more, especially homeowners. As of right now, we're really limited at the behest of contractors, which really puts solar and renewables outside the reach of most people. And with all the latest technological advancements, it seems like we could do more to help consumers, help themselves, if you will.
Great question, Jamie. Azar, to what extent is this fund, potentially useful for things like this, subsidizing solar for people's houses, for example, or community solar projects?
Well, this is really the kind of projects that this fund is meant to do, and that's precisely what the worry is. Because the point of all of have and one thing is that this fund is made out of alternative compliance payments by utilities and power companies, and it has ballooned over 800 million because the companies are not paying are not basically using the state's renewable energy portfolio standard, which requires them to source some clean energy, a part of their distribution from clean energy sources. And because they're not doing it, there's a compliance payment that they need to make them, which is actually going into this particular pot of money. So it's not a good thing in itself. But then the second problem is that, exactly as our caller said, that for all those programs that should bring some better circumstance for consumer, particularly at this point in time when actually there's a lot of strain coming from sort of a generation side of things, we don't see that there's a lot of money being left in this pot. But going forward, I think one of the bills, which is the Affordable Solar Act, that's one of the efforts made by at least it's from Lori Chalkudian to again to redirect some of the money from CEIF into a dedicated fund for competitive solar procurement. But again, that's a future that's in future. There's another, the Abundant Affordable Clean Energy bill, which is about deploying utility scale solar, sorry, batteries and virtual power plants. So there's a lot of mix right now that is happening, but that's exactly why the Moore administration's entire political agenda is around affordable and reliable energy in this year.
Speaking of energy costs and affordability, one big project that could help meet electricity demand in Maryland is offshore wind. You've reported on offshore wind. There's a big project planned near Ocean City, but the Trump administration has been trying to scuttle offshore wind projects all over the country. So, New York, New England. What is the situation right now here in Maryland?
That's correct. Actually, 8.5 gigawatts are supposed to have been estimated from this investment. But the situation, Rebecca, with offshore wind projects in Maryland is pretty much in a holding pattern, and that's because of the legal and procedural uncertainties around it. There's, of course, a very hostile political administration, which wants to see offshore wind industry kind of dead on arrival because of its fixation with fossil fuel, coal, oil drilling, and fracking. And then there's an ongoing legal and procedural challenges, which are kind of proving to be costly for the project developers. And we're talking about US Wind here, which has already secured construction permit for their 2.2 gigawatts of wind farm off the coast of Maryland and Delaware. Now, there are two other companies which have leases offshore, but they don't have approved construction plans. So technically, US Wind is the closest to begin construction, which is, and like you said, offshore wind is a key plank of Moore's strategy to get the state to achieve its climate targets with this with 8.5 gigawatts to be generated from wind. But despite the national victories, which kind of struck down President Trump's executive order that was blocking wind energy projects, Maryland's offshore wind situation is more complicated because there are still ongoing legal and procedural challenges that it is having to navigate.
Yeah, so it's still a long way off. I'm Rebecca Hersher, and this is Midday. I'm speaking with Aman Azhar, a reporter covering the DMV for Inside Climate News. We're talking about the uncertain future for offshore wind farms planned on Maryland's Atlantic coast. If you'd like to join that conversation, give us a call, 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. So, Aman, I want to ask you, does US Wind, the company that you mentioned behind the permitted Maryland offshore wind project, does it have the option to just wait out this administration and hope that there is a new president who's maybe less hostile, more supportive of wind energy in 2028?
Well, that will not happen, unfortunately. In fact, they pleaded before the Baltimore judge that this is already becoming very expensive enterprise project for them. And the problem is that all their construction is tied to timelines and supply chains and procurements, which are on paper tied to everything that they want to do within a certain point in time. And that's if those timelines move, costs will move. And they have actually said in December that, and this is the company's high ups, which said that this could drive the company to bankruptcy. Now, that's a pretty serious thing. And the other thing is that the original IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, had tax credits for wind, which were kind of scheduled to phase out around 2032 to 2033. But President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act kind of moved those timelines. It says that wind and solar facilities that begin construction after July 2026 are not going to be eligible, for clean electricity tax credit only unless they are placed in service before January 1st of 2028. So these are even more compressed timeline for U.S. Wind to start construction by July 2026. And right now, the situation with Interior Department having, saying that they wish to kind of just revoke their permit, and then the separate case with the Ocean City and their co-plaintiffs, they're proving to be way too uncertain for them to execute their construction. And that exactly is what is putting everything in limbo right now.
I wonder, with all of the opposition at the federal level to these types of offshore wind farms, and with the sort of business reality of delays potentially killing these things, even if the pulling of the permit doesn't end up holding up in court, is that pushing Maryland state leaders away from wind and maybe toward other types of clean energy that, you know, might be more appealing right now because they're under less direct fire from the Trump administration?
Yeah, that's I think that really is what the political calculus is looking like. In fact, Delegate Charkudian said a little while back that she thinks that, you know, U.S. wind might not be, or rather the investments that the state wanted to see coming online in offshore wind may be delayed by a few years. That's consequential, of course, for Maryland's climate targets, which are just around the corner. And so there is definitely a move towards more sort of battery, and we can see that actually in the legislative agenda. I mean, like the two bills that I mentioned earlier on, the Affordable Solar Act, that's definitely one thing which they're trying to move in. And the estimate is that if this proposal goes through, it could add up to 4,000 megawatts by 2035. Now, there's an abundant, affordable, clean energy bill, which is, again, utility-scale batteries, you know, as an alternative to new gas generation. We know that last year, the Moore administration approved a bill which kind of fast-tracks gas generation in the state, which kind of blindsided environmental groups as well. They weren't happy about it. So now we see these proposals coming in. There's also a PJM alternatives study proposed as a legislative bill. And this is one of the, I find it quite significant and, may I say, audacious bills of the session, because it's almost like requiring a formal study of alternatives to Maryland's membership in PJM, the RTO, the Regional Transmission Organization that provides kind of distributed electricity quota in Maryland. So there are a bunch of legislative proposals which I see are trying to kind of steer in a direction that could provide some cushion away from the wind, because the situation clearly is not looking good for that.
Yeah. Aman Uzer is a reporter for Inside Climate News covering the DMV area. Thanks for joining us, Aman.
Thank you very much.
Up next, is Baltimore ready for more severe flooding as the planet gets hotter? Ava Richardson, the leader of Baltimore's sustainability office, and Ben Zeitchik, the chair of the Earth Science Department at Johns Hopkins University, join me on the other side of a quick break. I'm Rebecca Hersher. This is Midday. Stay with us.
This is member-supported 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm host Rebecca Hersher. My regular job is a correspondent for NPR's Climate Desk, where I cover how a rapidly changing climate affects, well, everything. You and me, our way of life, the whole planet. For today's show, I'm excited to turn more local to climate-related stories affecting Baltimore. I live here, just like you. And flooding is among the biggest climate-related threats to this city. Climate change is intensifying flood risks here. Sea levels are rising faster in the mid-Atlantic than in many other parts of the country. And here's a wild fact. The heaviest rainstorms in this region are dropping 60% more rain now than they were in the second half of the 20th century. That's according to the National Climate Assessment. To walk us through the city's reaction to all of this is Ava Richardson, the Sustainability Director for the Baltimore City Office of Sustainability. That's part of the city's Department of Planning. And Dr. Ben Zeitchik, the chair of the Earth Science Department at Johns Hopkins University and an expert on climate change and flooding. He's also the American Geophysical Union's president-elect, which I know you won't toot your own horn, Dr. Zeitchik, but it's kind of a big deal. You'll be leading the country's top trade group for earth scientists. Director Richardson joins me here in Studio A. Hello, on this very rainy morning.
Hello, Rebecca. Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
And Dr. Zajcik joins us via Zoom. Hi.
Hi there, Rebecca. Thanks for having me.
You can join us too. Is your neighborhood underwater sometimes? Do you feel prepared for the rainiest rainstorms? Give us a call at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. Or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Director Richardson, I want to start with you. Baltimore has a lot of water. Most people will immediately think of the harbor, but there are also a lot of rivers and streams, Jones Falls, Gwynn's Falls, Herring Run, the Gunpowder. You run the city's sustainability office, which includes flood management for Baltimore. Are we seeing more flooding here, in recent years compared to the past?
Yes, Rebecca, we are. And if I could just take a step back and share a little bit more general information about the Office of Sustainability, I just wanted to share, all of our work is really focused on advancing a more sustainable, equitable, and resilient city. And a lot of that work unfolds through the implementation of several citywide plans that we manage, including our 2019 Sustainability Plan, our 2023 Disaster Preparedness and Planning Project, or DP3. And that's our hazard mitigation plan for the city that really outlines a comprehensive strategy for how we mitigate and adapt to our changing climate and has the latest data science and research in terms of what our climate risks are across Baltimore, as well as our 2024 Climate Action Plan. And that particular plan can be viewed as our climate mitigation plan. Between these three plans, as well as other plans across the city, we are actively implementing over 600 actions across the city to pursue that vision for a more sustainable and equitable city. So to address your specific question about flooding, in our 2023 Disaster Preparedness Plan, we do see the data and the research. We actually, in that particular report, have information of flooding going back to 1996. So in the DP3, we are able to see that until recently, nuisance flood planning or nuisance flooding probably happened around 10 times per year. And now we're seeing that go up to around 25 times per year.
More than double.
Yes. And by 2050, our DP3 projects that we could see between 50 to 160 instances of that flooding.
What is nuisance flooding? Just for people who might not know what those words mean.
Yeah. So that's flooding that's different from coastal flooding in terms of its kind of like nature, in terms of like happening on sunny days. So really not necessarily related to like those coastal surges, but more specifically related to kind of like localized flooding areas.
Got it. Okay. And I'll bring Dr. Zajcik in here. You study flooding and climate change. You've worked on sustainability issues here in Baltimore for many years. And we know that as the earth gets hotter, intense rainstorms are getting more common. I've definitely experienced that firsthand here in Baltimore. Can you explain, why that is and what people should expect here as the earth continues to heat up?
Yeah, sure. So the idea that we're going to see more intense rainstorms really in many parts of the world is a pretty clear consequence of having a warmer atmosphere. It's simple physics. Warmer air holds more water. And when you have more water vapor in the air, well, that's going to turn, directly into the raindrops that we all feel coming down. But it also provides the fuel for a storm, because when that water vapor condenses to form raindrops, it releases heat and hot air rises. And so then as you release heat and condense more water vapor, you get more powerful rising air that really drives that storm to extremes. And so, again, the science on this is really quite clear, and we're seeing it. It's not just a theoretical point. In our opening, you just pointed out that we've seen this large increase here in Maryland. And Maryland being in the Mid-Atlantic here, this is one of the places we're seeing some of the fastest wetting and fastest rates of accelerating increase in these extreme storm events.
And without getting too much into the, really technical science, why is that? Why is Maryland such a hot spot? Because I think for many people, it would seem that, sea level rise should be the same everywhere. Rain should be basically the same everywhere, getting worse for everyone. But it seems like it's getting worse for us faster.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we talk about the rain here in the Mid-Atlantic, we're already kind of a humid zone. And so you're not going to be water limited. There might be parts of the world where it's a little drier, where this trend towards warmer air holding more moisture could be limited by the fact that the surface is dry and there's just not that much evaporation. But obviously here in Maryland, that's not what's limiting for us with the bay, with all the vegetation that we've got. And so we're in a place where we're going to see those increases really happen quite quickly. And you mentioned sea level rise. And now if we're in the Maryland area, we're dealing not just with the fact that seas are rising everywhere, as you said, but also some of the ocean currents coming up the coast of the United States are going to lead to a faster regional sea level rise. And as I think many here know, that the land is sinking here. We're seeing the subsidence, the lowering of the land surface, even as the water heights increase. And so that combination is really kind of a double whammy for us. Put that together with more intense storms and flooding becomes a real, real concern.
I'm host Rebecca Hersher, and this is Midday. Ava Richardson, the leader of Baltimore's Sustainability Office, and Ben Zeitchik, the head of the Earth Science Department at Johns Hopkins University. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. And Director Richardson, I want to talk a little bit about the effects of all this extra water. It seems like, in many cases, it is overwhelming the city's stormwater systems when we get these really heavy rainstorms, especially coupled with high tides downtown. You know, for example, I've personally seen the flooding that happens near Hill and Road during big storms. The sidewalks around the Inner Harbor are sometimes covered in water, especially during really high tides. Are there other hot spots that you're working on, and how does your office, approach some of these problems?
Yep, great question, Rebecca. I'll share a little bit about the city's and the office's management of the National Flood Insurance Program in the city of Baltimore. And so, in general, we manage the NFIP, and as a part of that process, we also participate in the community rating system. And so, this is a system that kind of rates local governments in terms of what they're doing. Or scores local governments in terms of what they're doing to support flood mitigation and prevention. As a part of Baltimore's participation in the CRS, we have a class 5, which is one of the highest in the state of Maryland, and that is able to save our ratepayers, our policyholders across the city, around $800,000 a year in terms of their flood insurance premiums. And so roughly, policyholders can save around 25% on their policies as the result of Baltimore City's participation in the CRS. We are also working on releasing the city's first watershed master plan. And so this particular plan is going to focus on both water quality and water quantity. So we're looking at how we can support ways to prevent flooding of different types, but also looking at ways that we can improve water quality at the local level. These particular watershed master plans that we're working on right now will focus on the Inner Harbor and the Gwynns Falls watershed. So we won't be focusing comprehensively on all the watersheds across the city, but we are definitely in a good place as a city when it comes to our floodplain code. We have a floodplain code that's more strict than what we see at the state of Maryland, as well as far more strict than the federal floodplain code as well. So as a city, we've taken much more protective efforts and strategies to ensure that development that's happening across the city is in alignment with kind of like those flood risks that we see across the city.
So it's a citywide issue. And that actually gets at a question that we have via email from Stephanie in Baltimore. She says that she's surprised at how much flooding there is, even after a short hard rain or on a day, you know, with light rain after another day of light rain, that it doesn't seem to take much to cause water to pool in the streets. And that she's surprised at how little people know about flooding in the city, especially in neighborhoods that maybe aren't in, say, Fells Point, where it's obvious that you're next to the water. I want to bring in Dr. Zeitchik. You've worked in many communities. What are some of the solutions that places outside Baltimore and here in Baltimore are using to address this issue of too much water for the infrastructure that was maybe built for a previous climate?
Sure. And first of all, to Stephanie's point, I think we've all experienced that, this kind of surprise about how quickly areas can flood. It doesn't seem obvious that should happen. And the urban landscape is really complex. And so we can see different local features in the landscape, like a lot of impervious surface, or perhaps some leaks that we don't know about, or some zones of concentration. And suddenly you do see water either on the surface or in people's basements. And it's a challenge that, you know, city agencies and we as researchers are working on all the time. Now, I think the good news is that there are a lot of creative solutions, and that City of Baltimore is a place that's really embracing multiple approaches. When you look around both Baltimore, the region, and the world, really, one concept that has really come into play is the idea of a spongy city, that instead of just saying, well, let's get all the water out into a drain as quickly as possible and out to the harbor, maybe what we want to be able to do is absorb some of that locally in a way that delays the peak. And so you kind of absorb and then gradually release this water. And so that can mean green infrastructure, right? We've seen a lot of tree planting, a lot of attempts to use green space and other kind of innovative landscape ways to get the water out of zones of concentration and to slow down that peak flow. And it also means a combination of those kinds of green infrastructure solutions with some gray infrastructure. You certainly need both. And sometimes you want to plan to get that water out of a place quickly, that's prone to flooding. And other times you're just going to say, let's hold that water in the landscape to avoid contributing a burst of water downstream. So a lot of projects happening here in Baltimore and in other cities. And it's really actually quite an exciting time to see cities innovate in their adaptation to these changes.
I like that perspective that it's an exciting time and not just a frustrating or scary time. There's so much change with climate change. I want to talk a little bit about money because you just outlined a lot of different things that cities can do, some things that Baltimore is doing to try to control some of this water, slow it down, allow the ground to absorb it, upgrading stormwater systems, in the city, overhauling the sewage system might be part of, a flood-related thing. A lot of people have to deal with sewage when there's a lot of rain. This is very, very expensive work. Can Baltimore afford to make itself more resilient to flooding? Director Richardson?
Rebecca, I would say that no city cannot afford not to invest in these issues. And so what we see is roughly a six kind of like dollar return on investment when we see cities and any entity investing in resilience, mitigation, and adaptation. So we really, while yes, the cost of addressing these issues are considerable, but the cost of not acting is even greater. Oftentimes, I think climate issues and even public health issues, when it comes to how we prevent these issues, like investing in that prevention can be a real challenge for anyone. It's hard to set aside the funds for the disaster that has not yet happened. And so it's so critical that we do not wait for that disaster event. We've seen and heard about the flooding in Texas, or we've heard about, obviously, we all remember Katrina coming, in the 25th year anniversary last year. But it is so critical that we act to mitigate the impacts of disaster events and climate extremes before we have that serious impact on property and human life. I think we are doing exactly that with the execution of our Watershed Master Plan for the city of Baltimore. And also wanted to go back to the caller's question because in terms of the lived experiences of our residents, that is so important to bring into our work. And that's why I really want to tell people to, look on our website to find out more about the Watershed Master Plan, because we want to hear about those instances in terms of how have you interacted with heavy rains or flooding? Like, what has been your experience? And what are the ideas for solutions that folks have? We want that to be reflected in our planning process as well. But no city, no government, no state can afford at all not to invest in climate mitigation and adaptation today.
Yeah. Ava Richardson is the director of the Baltimore Office of Sustainability. Dr. Ben Zaitchik is the chair of the Earth Science Department at Johns Hopkins University. He's also president-elect of the American Geophysical Union. Thank you both for joining me today. And that's it for today. Coming up on Monday, WYPR host Gabe Ortiz speaks with members of the Baltimore Sun Guild. Fresh Air is up next. I'm Rebecca Hersher, a correspondent for NPR's Climate Desk. Thanks for tagging along on our roundup of climate stories today. Remember to be careful out there as snow potentially returns to our region. And have a great weekend, everybody.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.